Ads heard during the podcast that are not in my voice are placed by third-party agencies outside of my control and should not imply an endorsement by Weird Darkness or myself.
Stories and content in Weird Darkness can be disturbing for some listeners and is intended for mature audiences only. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
In the few months either side of Christmas 1970, a bizarre crime wave shocked the city of Bucharest. At the time, nobody knew who ventured out late at night with an axe, an iron bar, a hammer, or a knife to target lone restaurant staff on their way home from work. All of these attacks took place in the early hours of the morning. Each time, the weather was extreme. Mild and calm nights seemed to keep the criminals at bay. As a direct result of these attacks, the women of Bucharest were fearing for their lives. They would go out after dark in the company of chaperones, either large groups of women or in the company of a trusted man. The lack of details issued by the investigating officers didn't help ease any fears. If anything, withholding crucial information only acted as fuel that sparked wild imaginations. I'm Darren Marlar. Welcome to Weird Darkness. Welcome, Weirdos. I'm Darren Marlar, and this is Weird Darkness. Here you'll find stories of the paranormal, supernatural, legends, lore, the strange and bizarre, crime, conspiracy, mysterious, macabre, unsolved, and unexplained. Coming up in this episode, a neural network named Norman is disturbingly different from other types of artificial intelligence, or AI. How? Well, for one, it's a psychopath. 20 high school students all lost consciousness and collapsed under mysterious circumstances during class. Was it mass hysteria? Juju in Ghana? Or did the students actually see ghosts, as they claim? At a young age, Edmund Kemper decapitated his sister's dolls and even stalked his second-grade teacher with a bayonet. But he was young and just getting started. During the Second World War, in the gruesome world of Unit 731, the unthinkable was done on a daily basis. Prisoners were subjected to unimaginable horrors. Today, ghostly voices are heard, and anomalies frequently appear in photographs. But first, Ian Rimmerou is a murderer like no other. Vampirism, cannibalism, necrophilia, and why shouldn't he? I mean, after all, he's taking after his serial killer father. We begin with that story. If you're new here, welcome to the show. While you're listening, be sure to check out WeirdDarkness.com for merchandise, my newsletter, to enter contests, to connect with me on social media. Plus, you can visit the Hope in the Darkness page if you're struggling with depression or dark thoughts. You can find all of that and more at WeirdDarkness.com. Now, bolt your doors, lock your windows, turn off your lights, and come with me into the Weird Darkness. People have often questioned what exactly makes a killer. Is it nature or nurture? Heredity or upbringing? This case of Ian Rimmerou, dubbed the Vampire of Bucharest and the Wolfman, may reveal that it's actually both. Interestingly, both Ian and his father, Florea Rimmerou, were extremely brutal serial murders in their own times. Ian Rimmerou's animalistic murder spree from 1970 to 1971 in Romania was so notorious that innocent namesakes legally altered their surnames rather than have any association with Rimmerou. Bucharest was on high alert during that year when the so-called Vampire of Bucharest of the Blonde's Killer was on the loose. Rimmerou's final tally entered into the double figures, with four murders from the umpteen attacks on women. Each time, His method was identical and brutal to the extreme. Ian used an axe and a metal rod to mutilate the women. He bit flesh off of all his victims repeatedly, and authorities believe that he ate some of the parts. Some victims who survived also testified that Ian poked holes in them and drank their blood. Little did anyone know that Ian's father, Floreia Romaru, had committed 4 murders in 1944, 2 years before Ian was even born in October of 1946. All the crimes occurred during stormy weather at the victims' ground floor apartments. Also, they had all been bashed in the head with a blunt weapon. As you will see, the details of these cases will match closely to the crimes of Ian Romaru. Floreia left behind shoe and fingerprints at his crime scenes. However, authorities never caught him. Those pieces of evidence would later reveal his guilt, but not until it was too late to punish him. Ian's father planted the seeds for his child's brutality early in Ian's life. As the eldest child, Ian witnessed his father's abuse of his mother on a daily basis. Floreia Romaru finally left and moved to Bucharest, but he left behind a raging misfit that courted trouble. Before his conviction of aggravated theft when he was 18, Ian had already forged a reputation for himself. Forced to repeat the 9th grade, it was discovered that he had an ongoing sexual relationship with his teacher's underage daughter. Despite all this, though, Ian passed his formal education and acquired passing grades. In 1966, a grade of 5.33 out of 10 was good enough to see Ian secure a place at the Faculty of Veterinary Medicine University. One of the professors there noticed that Ian was shy and semi-literate with a limited vocabulary and not many interests. These are facts that might explain why he had to repeat his second and third years of study. Roommates also noticed that he tended to behave oddly, and they preferred to ignore him whenever possible. According to one student, Romaru opted to patrol the dormitory outside a female's room one night rather than get some sleep. On top of these bizarre behaviors, a year after entering university, doctors diagnosed Ian with esophageal spasms, a reactive nervous syndrome, and other mental problems. In the few months either side of Christmas 1970, a bizarre crime wave shocked the city of Bucharest. At the time, nobody knew who ventured out late at night with an axe, an iron bar, a hammer, and a knife to target lone restaurant staff on their way home from work. All of these attacks took place in the early hours of the morning. Each time, the weather was extreme. This paralleled Ian's father's crimes. Mild and calm nights seemed to keep the criminals at bay. As a direct result of these attacks, the women of Bucharest were fearing for their lives. They would only go out after 9 p.m. in the company of chaperones, either large groups of women or in the company of a trusted man. The lack of details issued by the investigating officers didn't help ease any fears. If anything, withholding crucial information only acted as fuel that sparked wild imaginations. Only after Ian committed several crimes did police officers realize that they were the work of the same individual. The investigation lasted a year, and survivors did help with the arrest of Romaru in May 1971. Being just one of the estimated 2,500 suspects interviewed, the decisive factor in his arrest was a medical diagnosis sheet that investigators found at the scene of a murder. On March 4, 1971, 6 doctors all came to the conclusion that Ian suffered from periodic bouts of epilepsy. A note from one of the doctors, Octavian Ionist, was discovered beneath the brutalized body of Mihaela Ursa. Clutched between her fingers was a strand of hair that was all investigators needed to identify the man responsible. However, this identification came too late to prevent additional attacks. Romaru no longer targeted waitresses. He was willing and more than able to target any woman, whether they were alone or not. Romaru's reign of terror came to an end when the police investigating the medical note were in the midst of a process of elimination for all of that particular doctor's patients. Romaru was not at his dorm room when police arrived, but they went in and searched the premises. During the search, Romaru returned with his arsenal of weapons inside a bag. Forensic investigation matched the hair at the crime scene to Ian's. Hence, they had an open and shut case. Police charged Romaru with 23 violent crimes. Investigators had initiated Operation Vulture and had managed to draw on the services of 6,000 members of law enforcement agencies, 100 cars, 40 motorcycles, and various members of the public from many walks of life. Even with this impressive dragnet scouring the streets of Bucharest, Romaru managed to commit one more murder and scores of frenzied attacks before finally being caught. Once he was arrested, Romaru took the right to remain silent. Literally. In custody, he did little more than stare into space without any apparent emotion. This was a far cry from the ferocious and cruel sadist that had scared an entire city witless for close to an entire year. Women especially began to feel a little safer with Romaru safely behind bars. The threat of being attacked or mauled while alive, or beaten and raped after death by a misogynistic lunatic, meant that urban life could begin to return to normal. Since he was not volunteering any additional information, the police plotted a strategy of placing an undercover officer in jail with him in order to pry a confession from him. The undercover officer posed as a thief and managed to get a confession for over 20 violent crimes after 2 months of painstaking work. However, they only charged Romaru with 3 murders. At first, Romaru tried to convince the authorities that he was not responsible on the grounds of insanity. He claimed he didn't realize that the women involved would suffer or die. However, he did actually admit to the charges. Police asked him to visit the scenes of his atrocious crimes. Additionally, surviving witnesses participated in lineups, and they would tremble visibly when they made eye contact with Ian. Authorities generally concluded that comments made by his own father, Florea, had a large part to play in the transformation from innocent child to insane monster. It's possible that Florea coached or counseled Ian, but there is no evidence of this. While the initial manhunt was taking place for Ian, police arrested Florea 3 times. However, this was in connection to Ian's crimes rather than Florea's own. Each time, though, they released him because Romanian law would not allow close family members to testify against each other. Ian Romaru's trial hinged largely on the insanity defense. Public attention to the trial was immense, and the proceedings took a dramatic turn when Romaru pleaded insanity. Although Romaru thought that he had convinced officials of his mental instability, a report stated otherwise. Mental illness did not cloud Romaru's judgment, and he knew what he was doing all along. Romaru changed his plea and subsequently refused to answer any questions from that point onward. The judge sentenced Ian Romaru to death by firing squad, and all his appeals failed. So, on October 23, 1971, officers took Ian to his place of execution. 3 of the officers had to physically move him. After they tied him to a stake, Romaru tried to bite off his own clothes. He twisted himself around the pole in a futile effort to avoid punishment. Romaru begged for his own father to come and witness the execution, as he said he was the only one who was guilty. The firing squad carried out the sentence. Ian Romaru lies in the town cemetery now in an unmarked grave. Oddly, exactly 1 year to the day after the execution of Ian Romaru, Florea Romaru officially fell off a train. However, other Romanian sources say that security pushed him out. Florea died that day. Follow-up forensic tests determined that his shoe size, fingerprints, and height all matched the evidence and testimony from the serial murders of 1944. Dr. Boutois, the psychologist, theorizes that a gene predisposing one to violent crimes was transmitted from father to son, as the murders happened under remarkably similar circumstances.
Coming up,
20 high school students all lost consciousness and collapsed under mysterious circumstances during class. Did the students actually see ghosts, as they claim? Plus, at a young age, Edmund Kemper decapitated his sister's dolls and even stalked his second-grade teacher with a bayonet. But he was young and just getting started. And during the Second World War, in the gruesome world of Unit 731, the unthinkable was done on a daily basis. Prisoners were subjected to unimaginable horrors, and today ghostly voices are heard and anomalies frequently appear in photographs. These stories and more when Weird Darkness returns. Nothing goes better with chocolate than vanilla, and nothing goes better with the darkness than vampires. So we've combined all of them into a new blend of weird dark roast coffee called Very Vampilla. This bloody good blend combines a medium dark roast coffee with hints of chocolate, vanilla, and just a tad bit of dried cherry too. So good, you'll want to sink your fangs into the fresh roasted bag itself. Weird Dark Roast Very Vampilla. The only thing at stake, sorry, not sorry, bad pun, is your dissatisfaction with your old coffee. Sip it while the sun is down if you're one of the undead, or when the sun is up if you just feel dead and need a bit of a boost. Get your Weird Dark Roast Very Vampilla at WeirdDarkness.com/coffee. That's WeirdDarkness.com/coffee. Is it mass hysteria or another case of juju in Ghana? Is there a difference? According to Daily Guide Africa, 20 high school students lost consciousness and collapsed under mysterious circumstances during class this week, Tuesday, July 3rd. The affected students had complained about seeing ghosts, including the spirits of classmates who had died before collapsing, according to classmates. The incident occurred at Nungua Senior High School in Accra on Tuesday morning. The group of students all seemingly collapsed and lost consciousness at the same time. Whether it was instantaneous or just roughly at the same time was not stated. There seemed to be no material cause for the students' collapse, and they were rushed to the nearby Lekma Hospital, where they were being treated. According to the guide, doctors at Lekma Hospital have attributed the bizarre event to mass hysteria. Yet at least the claims of a paranormal aspect have been corroborated. Dr. Joseph Oliver Comey, who is treating the students at Lekma Hospital, says, "They rushed to the emergency room with some behaving abnormally, but we found out that most of them were suffering from hysteria. They said they had seen things, some seeing ghosts, some seeing other students who are dead. We can't work with that as clinicians, so we have managed them. They are currently very stable, and they are waiting to see the clinical psychologist. We've seen close to 18 students and we're observing 3 others. By the end of the day, we'll hand them over to the school authorities who are still here." It's a tough nut to crack. If they had indeed seen visions of spirits, including some they know, and then lost consciousness and collapsed, seeming a little hysterical after the fact is probably pretty normal. Of course, in a place where there is a real fear and belief in juju and the paranormal, seeing one or two of your friends collapse from mundane causes like heat exhaustion or any of the other myriad reasons that people pass out could very well trigger a cascade of panic attacks, resulting in more collapsing and more panic. Mass hysteria is one of those catch-all terms to describe bizarre things that no one understands. It's not a disease in the regular sense. Having been blamed for both events like this as well as events like the Salem witch trials, although that is very much debated, it has still been considered a possible cause, which was an entirely different type of event. It seems like mass hysteria is just an easy thing to say when a group of people claim to have experienced something out of the norm. Strangely, this isn't the first time this has happened. A very similar event took place in Tanzania in 2008, when 20 girls all rapidly fell unconscious during school. Other mass collapses have been reported all over the world as well. Maybe mass hysteria is the right term. Sometimes groups of people do just completely lose their minds all at once. Does that make it any less strange? Would that be an argument against the paranormal or in favor of it? It's hard to tell. Though recently revisited in the Netflix series Mindhunters, one of the most heinous and often overlooked serial killers of American history is the co-ed killer Edmund Kemper III. At 6 feet 9 inches, with an IQ of 145, Edmund Kemper was an intimidating killer in every sense of the word. Kemper's murderous impulses can be traced back to his childhood, where he presented troubling behavior in a family ill-equipped to deal with his problems. His father, Edmund Emil Kemper II, was a World War II veteran who was in a loveless and damaging marriage with his mother, Clarnell Elizabeth Kemper. Clarnell was an alcoholic, possibly suffering from borderline personality disorder. The older Kemper, who had worked on nuclear bomb tests in the Pacific, once said that suicide missions in wartime and the later atomic bomb testings were nothing compared to living with Clarnell. Clarnell would berate her husband for what she perceived as his menial job and refused to coddle her son for fear that it would turn him gay. At the same time, Kemper began to display dark fantasies relating to sexuality and death. He would decapitate his sister's dolls in elaborate rites and even stalked his second-grade teacher outside her house carrying his father's bayonet. At the age of 10, he killed his family's pet cat, and at the age of 13, he killed another, this time keeping pieces of the animal in his closet until his mother found them. In 1957, Kemper's father left the family, leaving him in the company of just his mother and two sisters. His mother feared Kemper, who already stood 6'4" at the age of 15, and made him sleep in a locked basement for fear that he would harm his sisters. She would regularly berate and insult him, telling the boy that no woman would ever love him. Kemper ran away from his mother's house to live with his father in California. However, his father had remarried and sent Kemper to live with his grandparents on their ranch. There, Kemper transferred much of his rage for his parents toward these, his new stewards. After getting into an argument with his grandmother, Kemper shot her in the head with his grandfather's .22 caliber rifle. He then killed his grandfather as he was walking up the driveway toward the house. So, according to Kemper, he would not have to find out his wife was dead. Kemper turned himself in to the police after calling his mother and asking what to do. Kemper was then sent to the criminally insane unit of Atascadero State Hospital. It was there that he was first tested for his IQ and learned of his high score. On Kemper's 21st birthday in 1969, he was finally released from Atascadero back into the care of his mother, who was now working as an administrative assistant at the University of California, Santa Cruz. He still had to check in with probation psychologists, but knew what to say to them from his experiences at Atascadero and was considered a low risk. After a year, Kemper began living in places across Northern California, periodically returning to his mother's house in Aptos when he'd run out of money. It was at this time that Kemper embarked on his infamous murder spree, where he would pick up young women who were hitchhiking and murder them, have sex with their corpses, and dismember their bodies. His first victims were Mary Ann Pess and Anita Luchesa, two Fresno State students he encountered while driving around Berkeley, California. Kemper brought the women to a wooded area nearby where he originally intended to rape them, but panicked and ended up stabbing and choking the two women to death. He then stuffed their bodies in his trunk and drove over to his house in Alameda, where he was living at the time. On the way, a police officer stopped him for a broken taillight but did not search the car. Once home, Kemper raped the bodies before dismembering them, placing the pieces of the bodies in plastic bags and disposing of them in a ravine near Loma Prieta Mountain. Kemper continued this formula of murder on his next victim, 15-year-old Korean dance student Aiko Koo. During this encounter, Kemper accidentally locked himself out of his car, but was able to persuade Koo to let him back in. By early 1973, Kemper had run out of funds and had moved back in with his mother at her home on the UC Santa Cruz campus. There, he continued his killings, murdering three more college students he picked up around the campus. He even buried one of the dismembered heads of his victims in his mother's garden and left it facing upward toward her bedroom. According to him, he did this because his mother always wanted people to look up to her. Then, on April 20, 1973, Kemper's murders reached their natural culmination when he bludgeoned his mother to death with a claw hammer while she slept in her bed. Kemper then decapitated her and raped her severed head before placing it on a shelf and using it as a dartboard. He cut out her tongue and larynx and placed them in the garbage disposal. Kemper then invited his mother's best friend over to the house before murdering her and stealing her car. He drove to Colorado, but after not hearing any news of the murders, ended up calling the police from a phone booth to confess to murdering his mother. The police did not take the call seriously, prompting Kemper to admit to all of the murders he had committed to get their attention. When asked why he turned himself in, Kemper said that the original purpose was gone. "I just said to hell with it all and called it off." He was arrested and convicted of 8 counts of first-degree murder. Kemper attempted suicide twice and even requested the death penalty, but failed on all counts and was given 7 consecutive life sentences. Edmund Kemper was imprisoned at the California Medical Facility alongside Herbert Mullen and Charles Manson, where he still resides to this day. While in prison, Kemper willingly participated in a number of interviews from reporters and law enforcement. As detailed in the TV show Mindhunters, Edmund Kemper's testimony as to his state of mind during his murders was integral to law enforcement's understanding of the mind of serial killers. Edmund Kemper became a model prisoner at the California Medical Facility, where he is in charge of scheduling other inmates' appointments with psychiatrists, and has spent over 5,000 hours narrating books on tape for the blind. Unit 731 was the code name of an Imperial Japanese Army unit officially known as the Kempeitai Political Department and Epidemic Prevention Research Laboratory. It was initially set up under the Kempeitai Military Police of the Empire of Japan to develop weapons of mass destruction for potential use against Chinese and possibly Soviet forces. Unit 731 was based at the Pingfang district of Harbin, the largest city in the Japanese-occupied state of Manchukuo, now northeast China. More than 95% of the victims who died in the camp based in Pingfang were Chinese and Korean, including both civilian and military. The remaining 5% were Southeast Asians and Pacific Islanders, at the time colonies of the Empire of Japan, and a small number of the prisoners of war from the Allies of World War II. According to the 2002 International Symposium on the Crimes of Bacteriological Warfare, the number of people killed by the Imperial Japanese Army Germ Warfare and Human Experiments is around 580,000. In the gruesome world of Unit 731, the unthinkable was done on a daily basis. Prisoners were subjected to unimaginable horrors. They were infected with diseases such as anthrax, cholera, and even bubonic plague. To gauge the effects of these diseases on their subjects, whom they dehumanized by calling them logs, unanesthetized vivisection was performed in many cases, the subjects being conscious while the dissection was taking place. Whole towns and villages were decimated by the ghoulish doctors and researchers of Unit 731, and the effects of their horrible crimes still resonate there to this day. Parts of the Unit 731 complex still remain. There are buildings where frostbite experiments were performed, courtyards and open areas where prisoners were subjected to live bombs detonated at close range to enable researchers to evaluate the effects of explosives of the sort the Japanese soldiers were encountering in the fields. Other buildings where the live human vivisections took place overlook the prisoner holding area and the long unused railway station where the prisoners were offloaded for their horrible fate. The Chinese government sanctioned the unit and the surrounding area as a learning center for future generations of Chinese, and just recently visitors from the West have been allowed access to the killing fields at Harbin. But for many years, there have been reports of paranormal activity associated with the old charnel houses. Ghost lights and apparitions are frequently seen, including a ghostly figure that walks the empty precincts surrounding the frostbite units. Ghostly voices have been heard, and anomalies frequently appear in photographs taken in the area. Recently, during the filming of a BBC television documentary, the English film crew experienced unexplainable problems with their lights and batteries, often a sign of ghostly activity. Many speculate that as the story of Unit 731 is more widely told, the ghosts of those tragically tormented and murdered are becoming more and more active. When Weird Darkness returns, a neural network named Norman is disturbingly different from other types of artificial intelligence, or AI. How? Well, for one, Norman is a psychopath. That story is up next. The town is Standard, a small Midwestern town where nothing ever happens. Quiet, peaceful, and tucked away among the cornfields and away from the dangers of the outside world. Unfortunately, there is nothing normal about Standard. There has been an evil that has been awakened, and now the residents are slowly going crazy. Men, for no reason, are coming home and murdering their families, and dark forms are appearing in people's mirrors. The evil is spreading, and now it's up to ex-Chicago cop Rob Aletto to find it. Time is running out, and the neighbors are becoming quiet shadows as they watch him. He doesn't have long before it'll start to get into his mind, and then he himself would be making that deadly trip home. Inside the Mirrors by Jason R. Davis, narrated by Weird Darkness host Darren Marlar. Hear a free sample or purchase the title on the audiobooks page at WeirdDarkness.com. A neural network named Norman is disturbingly different from other types of AI, or artificial intelligence. Housed at MIT Media Lab, a research laboratory that investigates AI and machine learning, Norman's computer brain was allegedly warped by exposure to the darkest corners of Reddit during its early training, leaving the AI with chronic hallucinatory disorder, according to a description published April 1st. Yes, April Fool's Day, on the project's website. MIT Media Lab representatives described the presence of something fundamentally evil in Norman's architecture that makes his retraining impossible, adding that not even exposure to holograms of cute kittens was enough to reverse whatever damage its computer brain suffered in the bowels of Reddit. This outlandish story is clearly a prank, but Norman himself, or itself, is real. The AI has learned to respond with violent, gruesome scenarios when presented with ink blots. Its responses suggest its mind experiences a psychological disorder. In dubbing Norman a psychopath AI, its creators are playing fast and loose with the clinical definition of the psychiatric condition, which describes a combination of traits that can include lack of empathy or guilt alongside criminal or impulsive behavior, according to Scientific American. Norman demonstrates its abnormality when presented with ink blot images. a type of psychoanalytical tool known as the Rorschach test. Psychologists can get clues about people's underlying mental health based on the descriptions of what they see when looking at these ink blots. When MIT Media Lab representatives tested other neural networks with Rorschach ink blots, the descriptions were banal and benign, such as an airplane flying through the air with smoke coming from it, or a black-and-white photo of a small bird, according to the website. However, Norman's responses to the same ink blots took a darker turn, with the psychopathic AI describing the patterns as man is shot dumped from car and man gets pulled into dough machine. According to the prank, the AI is currently located in an isolated server room in a basement with safeguards in place to protect humans' other computers and the internet from contamination or harm through contact with Norman. Also present in the room are weapons such as blowtorches, saws, and hammers for physically disassembling Norman to be used if all digital and electronic fail-safes malfunction, MIT Media Lab representative said. Further April Fool notes suggest that Norman poses a unique danger and that 4 out of 10 experimenters who interacted with the neural network suffered permanent psychological damage. There is to date no evidence that interaction with AI can be harmful to humans in any way. Neural networks are computer interfaces that process information similarly to the way a human brain does. Thanks to neural networks, AI can learn to perform independent actions, such as captioning photos, by analyzing data that demonstrates how this task is typically performed. The more data it receives, the more information it will have to inform its own choices, and the more likely its actions will be to follow a predictable pattern. For example, a neural network known as the Nightmare Machine, built by the same group at MIT, was trained to recognize images that were scary by analyzing visual elements that frightened people. It then took that information and put it to use through digital photo manipulation, transforming banal images into frightening, nightmarish ones. Another neural network was trained in a similar manner to generate horror stories. Named Shelley, after Frankenstein author Mary Shelley, the AI consumed over 140,000 horror stories and learned to generate original, terrifying tales of its own. And then there's Norman, which looks at a colorful ink blot that a standard AI described as a close-up of a wedding cake on a table and sees a man killed by speeding driver. But there may be hope for Norman. Visitors to the website are offered the opportunity to help the AI by participating in a survey that collects their responses to 10 ink blots. MIT Media Lab representatives suggest that their interpretations could help the wayward neural network fix itself. Thanks for listening. If you like the show, please share it with someone you know who loves the paranormal or strange stories, true crime, monsters, or unsolved mysteries like you do. And please leave a rating and review of the show in the podcast app you listen from. You can email me anytime with your questions or comments at Darren@WeirdDarkness.com. WeirdDarkness.com is also where you can find all of my social media, listen to audiobooks I've narrated, shop the Weird Darkness store, sign up for monthly contests, find other podcasts that I host, and find the Hope in the Darkness page if you or someone you know is struggling with depression or dark thoughts. Also on the website, if you have a true paranormal or creepy tale to tell, you can click on Tell Your Story. You can find all of that and more at WeirdDarkness.com. All stories in Weird Darkness are purported to be true unless stated otherwise, and you can find source links or links to the authors in the show notes. Donna Student's Faint After Seeing Ghosts was written by Sequoia Kennedy for Mysterious Universe. Serial Killer Edmund Kemper is by Gabe Paoletti for All That's Interesting. Unit 731 was posted at ghost-story.co.uk. The Disturbing Crimes of a Father and Son is by Les Hewitt for Historic Mysteries. Meet Norman, the Artificially Intelligent Psychopath was written by Mindy Weisberger for Live Science. Weird Darkness is a production and trademark of Marler House Productions. And now that we're coming out of the dark, I'll leave you with a little light. Revelation 1 verse 3, Blessed is the one who reads the words of this prophecy, and blessed are those who hear it and take to heart what is written in it, because the time is near. And a final thought, the top of one mountain is the bottom of the next, so keep climbing. I'm Darren Marlar. Thanks for joining me in the Weird Darkness.